Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 27th of April, 2022, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. And is it as cold up in Kent as it is down in Devon today, Phil?
Well, it's a bit fresh. Having to put the heating back on again today, which I was hoping to avoid.
Yes, I thought spring had finally arrived, but we're having a cold snap down here. Anyway, we can soon warm things up, can't we, with a lively discussion.
Let's do it.
What's caught your eye this week then, Phil?
Well, it's always good to know that big construction projects are moving forward, and one that may or may not be, but is sort of moving forward, is the Lower Thames Crossing, £8 billion new crossing of the River Thames that's proposed. It's not necessarily going to happen. It's still got to go through planning, but the news this week is that the procurement of a contracting team to build the actual tunnel bit of the project is moving to the next stage. It's what would normally be called invitation to tender, but it's actually invitation to participate in dialogue, which is ITPD rather than ITT, which I asked the National Highways, Highways England, I still want to call them, ours National Highways, two things. One is that they announced a shortlist for this contract a year ago. So why didn't you start talking to them a year ago? What's this whole, you know, participate in dialogue? What's that all about?
I know. It sounds almost as if, you know, they're not quite, they don't feel quite confident enough to ask people to tender for the contract. So they just want to make it look as if they're moving forward without actually doing anything. That's the way it seems on the surface. But I think that actually there's more to it than that, isn't there? It is actually a proper consultative process in terms of appointing a contractor.
Yes, I mean, it's the same as, same stage as, but a different procedure as the familiar invitation to tender. I mean, I think we're familiar with invitation to participate in dialogue as a method of picking a contractor from a framework, from a list of pre-qualified contractors who are already on a framework. And you can either do mini tenders from a framework, or you can just chat to them and see who you like the shape of the best there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a big old contract. It's 2.3 billion is the tunnel bit. The whole Lower Thames Crossing, for background, I'm sure everyone should know about it by now, is being proposed some way east of the Dartford Crossing, which is currently the most easterly crossing of the Thames. Dartford Crossing is the M25 bit. Although, interestingly, it's not actually the M25. The M25 stops and starts when it hits the Dartford Crossing.
Favourite pub quiz question, that one, isn't it?
I can imagine. So this will be, I don't know how far down. I'm going to say 10 miles, but I don't know. It's further east anyway, between Kent and Essex. And as well as the tunnel itself, there's a big contract to the north of a 1.3 billion pound contract estimated at to build all the roads in Essex, and there are a couple of people already shortlisted for that, and a 600 million pound contract to build roads in Kent on the Kent side of the tunnel. So you've got these three big elements, and they're all moving forward, the procurement of this, even though National Highways does not yet have a development consent order. They haven't even got a planning application in, which in this context have to put something into the planning inspectorate. They put something in last year, and we've talked about this before, and the planning inspectorate threw it back at them and said, that's inadequate, there's not enough information in this.
That's right.
Go back and try again. And rather than just sort of redo their homework, National Highways kind of went back to the drawing board and had a whole massive load of public consultation. Because they're aware there's a lot of opposition to this. Thames Crossing Action Group is a big campaigning group against the project. a lot of environmental opposition to it.
What are the objections? Why do people object to this? Is it just because they're going to concrete over the countryside? Is that it?
Basically, it's not so much. Yeah. What we're talking about here, certainly on the Kent side, is sort of marshes, which is rich in marshy type wildlife, birds, and so on. And there are an ancient woodland on the Essex side, I think, that is under threat. And National Highways, in broad terms, the National Highways' response is, "Don't worry, we'll plant loads of trees." And the argument against that is, well, no, that's not the same. You know, new trees are never as good as old trees. So there's that sort of argument going on. So it's not certain it'll go ahead. Personally, from a purely selfish me getting from my corner of Kent to the north of England, God's own country, and returning to my homeland, it could be quite handy to have a route that didn't take me across the Dartford crossing and get me up the east side of the country much more quickly.
Well, this process, this participation in dialogue, what does that actually mean? I mean, if they're not actually tendering for it, is it basically that the client wants the contracting teams to sit down and thrash out the plan with them, and then they will choose the one which they think is a sort of getting to know you type of exercise, where they think, yeah, I can work with these guys, and I like the cut of their jib sort of thing. Is that basically what it is? And then they'll just say, okay, you can have the contract.
Well, I think they've been talking to these people, not in the formal tendering or dialogue sense that they're now moving forward into.
Yeah, they must know who they are. They must already have had some dialogue with them.
I think they've been talking to these people in an informal sense for the past year since they were selected, possibly even before they were selected or shortlisted. But I'm not quite sure what the structure or format of those talks take. But all I'm told by National Highways at this stage is that it's a really, really complicated project due to the complex nature of what this contract needs to deliver. We've opted for the invitation to participate in dialogue process instead of invitation to tender. This means we are able to move on to the next stage of the procurement process while continuing discussions. There are subtleties that are beyond me, but I think National Highways, we've talked about the A14 before and how they brought all the different teams that were involved in different sections of that job together to make a team approach to do the whole thing. And that appears to have been a very smooth and successful operation. So I suspect there's a lot of learning from that coming to play.
Oh, it all sounds as if, to me, you know, this is sort of like Sir John Egan's legacy to a large degree, isn't it? I mean, this sort of approach wouldn't have taken place 20, 30 years ago to procure a big infrastructure project like this. It's
In those days,
to me, it smacks very much of the sort of partnering and open book accounting type approach to project procurement.
Yes, as you say, 20, 30 years ago, who wants the least money? Okay, you've got the job.
Yes, exactly.
But we're wiser now.
Yes, probably a good thing.
I mentioned before, though, the one thing that slightly saddens me, I suppose, is that this is a nationally significant infrastructure project, and I don't consider myself a little Englander. I was never a Brexiteer. I was always a fervent Remainer, and I stand accused of being a Remoner to this day, I suppose. Or at least I could be accused of being that fairly. But this is a nationally significant infrastructure project. And now that we've chosen to go alone, Britain as a country on its own, and we're not part of the European Union, we do seem remarkably hospitable to our former European partners taking all our big construction projects. And the tunnelling contract on the Lower Thames Crossing, I mentioned this before, with three joint ventures, two of them have no British involvement at all, no British owned. I know people are going to say, oh, well, Bam Nuttall is very British. They've been here for years. Yeah, but they're Dutch owned.
Yeah, but they're Dutch owned.
I mean, even, you know, W.S. Atkins, you think of as a fine British consulting engineer. Sorry, it's Canadian owned now. I believe it's Canadian SNC-Lavalin. Yes, Canadian owned.
Yes, yeah.
And Dragados and Hochtief. I don't think even Hochtief aren't even German anymore, I don't think, are they? Are Hochtief now Spanish? I don't know. but the only British contractor in there is Murphy, who are in joint venture with Bouygues. I did have to check whether Murphy actually were Irish, and obviously they've got Irish heritage, but it's a British. Sure. I think it's owned by, and it's a proper British company despite its Irish heritage. And they've got, as their consultant, they're in with Bouygues, the French big company.
Yeah.
And their designers are Mott MacDonald and Ove Arup, who are both still proper British employee-owned consultancy firms. Big fan of employee-owned firms as well.
Yeah. Yes, of course.
So Murphy is the only British contractor who's bidding for it, and they've got British design firms with them. Does it matter? I mean, not really. I'd much rather the job was done for the best value for money for the British taxpayer at the end of the day. But if we're moving towards nationally significant projects and national independence from the European Union,
yeah,
it'd be nice to think we had national capability to deliver these projects.
But I think with these huge mega infrastructure projects, you're always going to get these sort of international organizations. Yes, their head office might be in the Netherlands or Madrid or somewhere else, you know, other than the UK. But I mean, if it went to Balfour Beatty do most of their work overseas, even though they're a British firm. And I know they're still the biggest in the UK, but a lot of these companies are nominally sort of domiciled in a particular country, but they're actually active all over the place. And I think you could make an argument that, like, BAM Construction and BAM Nuttall, BAM Nuttall was, of course, Edmund Nuttall once upon a time, very much a British firm. And I imagine most of the people... Until the Dutch bought it, yeah, okay, yeah, I take your point. But I bet they would still consider themselves very much to be a British firm.
Yeah, they would certainly pitch themselves as that, unless it favoured them... to pitch themselves as an international or global firm. They're nothing like global BAM, are they? But they're certainly international. I mean, they've scaled back from Germany and Belgium and places.
Yeah.
Now, and we've talked before about the whole localism and social value and the local firms totally being prioritised in public works tendering. So I don't know whether the Britishness of the Murphy Bouygues team will score any points in its favour, or whether in the whole localism thing the government would regard Ferrovial or Hochtief as just as British as a British company.
Yeah, well, we simply don't know whether it's a factor at all, do we? As I say, on a big mega project like this, it's probably, the local involvement is probably less important compared to some of the other considerations. I mean, if you're talking about a bypass in Swindon or somewhere like that, then a Wiltshire-based firm would probably be in with an advantage. I don't know, but I would imagine that if they've got a local supply chain, that would really count. But with a job like this, it's huge, so you need to mobilise big forces, and by definition that can't, well, the local component of that is going to be smaller by comparison.
The local firm for this job, to my mind, would be Lang O'Rourke, of course, because their head office is right by Dartford Bridge, which I know is the wrong crossing, but they could just...
Not a million miles away.
They could just get in their canoes and paddle out to sea a little bit and get building.
So what's the next stage then? So they're going to be having this dialogue, presumably sitting around a table, drinking coffee, eating biscuits, talking about how they intend to deliver this project. How long is that going to go on for? Do they give any hint?
Yeah, well, they hope to be able to sign contracts about the same time as they hope to get the development consent order, which would be in about a year and a bit's time, summer 2023.
Right.
Putting themselves on course for... I don't know whether they would actually start digging before the end of 2023, but that's what they're aiming for.
Right.
And I think the procurement of the road packages on either side, which does have a higher British contingent bidding for it. You've got, who have we got on the, Kia are bidding, Balfour Beatty, Kia among the bidders for the Kent Roads package with Eiffage. Balfour Beatty are bidding on the Essex Road, on shortlisted for that. Actually, Kia, in both packages, are up for Kia Eiffage in joint venture. And Balfour Beatty. And Costain, I never quite know how British we should regard Costain these days, because they're London Stock Exchange listed, but I can't remember where we are with the... weren't they rescued, bought out by, was it Saudis or some of the Middle East or Malaysia, or I can't remember where.
Oh, that rings a bell. I'd forgotten about that. Yeah.
I can't remember what the ownership of Costain is. But of course, if you're on the stock exchange, as we said before, you don't entirely know, well, you do know, but you and I can't immediately see exactly where the shareholders come from.
No, that's right.
You know, what particular pension fund represents pensioners from which country and so on and so forth.
Hmm. Yeah.
So it becomes moot. I get that.
No, I always think of Costain as being a British firm, but again, it's to do with heritage and familiarity.
Technically, you know? Didn't Costain start on the Isle of Man? Am I imagining that?
Oh, I've no idea.
I know they
no idea at all.
They began as coffin builders in the First World War. That was their origins, and moved from making wooden boxes to making other wooden constructions. That was the origins of Costain.
Well, I never knew that.
I think it's an Isle of Man origin where they started.
Well, that's fascinating. They've come a long way.
Move on.
Yeah, well, talking of coffins, there's the perennial issue of the big health and safety bogeyman of asbestos has raised its ugly head again. Was it this week or last week?
Last week.
Work and Pensions.
Yes.
Yeah, the Work and Pensions Committee said we've got to step up and do something about all the asbestos that's lurking unseen in public buildings all over the country. Interesting point about this is that they were saying, you know, we're going to have to do a lot of work to improve the energy efficiency of our buildings, which will mean retrofitting insulation, that kind of thing. And that will probably disturb an awful lot of this asbestos, which has been safely sort of encapsulated in walls and ceilings and floors, I imagine, for an awfully long time, and it's all going to be disturbed by the work that has to be done in order to hit our carbon reduction targets. Yeah, they've set a deadline, haven't they? A 40-year deadline. In fact,
well, they're saying the HSE should set that deadline. The position at the moment, the report was into not into asbestos per se, but into the HSE's management of the issue, and the HSE's line is kind of where the asbestos is safely embedded, leave it be, don't touch it. If you do need to touch it, or if you think you're going to be touching it, check the register, get the approvals, licenses, do all the right thing, whatever. And as you say, as the MPs point out, we are at the front end of a massive building retrofit. I don't know if boom is the right word, it may well be a boom, but national program. And we need to, or the HSE needs to, set out a much clearer, more cogent asbestos plan and plan for industry, rather than just say, don't touch it, but if you do, here's what you do. We've actually got to be more proactive and say, right, time to monitor and get rid of asbestos in a structured way rather than an ad hoc way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, asbestos removal and mitigation is a minor industry in its own right now. It has been for a long time. So, I mean, I think we can see we can see certainly boom times looming for asbestos removals contractors. It's highly regulated. And, of course, you and I get regular reports from the HSE and other sources about people who are being prosecuted, fined and even imprisoned for the illegal disposal and disturbance of asbestos. So it has to be done by people with the right training, the right qualifications. So it's not just a matter of telling everybody to rip that asbestos out and get rid of it. You need an infrastructure, an industry that is capable of doing that as well. And presumably that means that we're going to have a lot more training and certification of asbestos removals contractors.
Three interesting statistics that struck me from the MP's, the committee report. One, which I sort of knew it was high, but I'm always surprised how high it is when I hear it. In 2019, the HSE reported that there were more than 5,000 asbestos-related deaths. And we think of asbestos as a 1970s thing, or earlier, but it's still, it's still being disturbed far too often.
Yeah.
And people who have been exposed to it in the past are still dying from that past exposure.
Yes.
So more than 5,000 asbestos-related deaths a year. I mean, that's quite a lot, and we don't hear that much about it. The second statistic I thought was interesting was asbestos is still around in about 300,000 non-domestic buildings, which presumably means schools, hospitals, factories, offices. 300,000 buildings with asbestos in it. And the third one was how few people check the register, how few builders check the register. The Institution of Occupational Health and Safety, Institution of Occupational Safety and Health, did a survey of 500 construction workers and found that a third had never ever checked the asbestos register before starting work on a new site. Now, the asbestos register is the go-to place to find out whether you're likely to encounter asbestos in a building that you're working on. And one in three of, why would I do that? Never occurred to me. Don't know anything about it. So there's quite a high level of ignorance there.
And are we just talking about public buildings, or are we talking or non-residential buildings here, or are we talking about all? I mean, does the register include domestic dwellings as well as non-residential buildings?
Do you know, I don't know that. I don't know that. I can't imagine it would be every building and bungalow.
I mean, I think the fact that we're sort of excluding from the discussion, we're excluding residential buildings, private residential buildings, is interesting because there's no doubt that a lot of those have asbestos-containing materials in them as well. I mean, I think that, you know, the textured ceilings and finishes like that, I think they in the past they were heavily asbestos-based, weren't they? So I certainly know that. In a house which I owned a long time ago, we had this horrible sort of Artex. Artex, I know, is a brand name. I don't know if it was Artex, but one of these textured finishes on the ceilings, which we wanted rid of. And our builder said, well, I'm not going to scrape it off because it's got asbestos in it. So instead, he put a skim of gypsum plaster over it, and job done. It was perfectly all right after that. But, I mean, that must be in houses all over the country, and other asbestos containing materials. I mean, asbestos cement sheets, stuff like that, I'm sure, in partitioning in various buildings. The thing is that this stuff is everywhere, and it was before people realized how lethal it was. It was this wonderful naturally occurring mineral that had fantastic properties. You know, it was insulating, it was fireproof or fire retardant, at least. You could use it for all sorts of things. And so, you know, it was used widely in all sorts of industries, and particularly in building. So I reckon it must be everywhere. It's probably in your house, probably in my house as well.
How to scare the listeners, David.
Well, the thing is, and this is another thing which I think is perhaps a little bit counterintuitive, which is that the official advice is if it is undisturbed, it's fine, just don't disturb it. Because it's when, you know, like an asbestos corrugated sheet roof, which are, you know, all over the place, you'll find them everywhere. It's when they get broken up and damaged that the fibres get released into the atmosphere, and they're then a danger. If it sits on a roof and it isn't deteriorating, then it's essentially harmless. But the thing is, I suppose, it's always there in the background. It's a bit like an unexploded bomb. You know, it's not doing you any harm at the moment, but, you know, if it were to deteriorate, then it could become a problem. So the thing is that I think probably the asbestos is this sort of like hidden problem. We know about it. We understand it. And clearly there's been some work done to try and quantify the extent of it. But I still think that there's an awful lot of unknown asbestos out there just waiting to raise its ugly head again. I mean, there's a site very near where I live, just basically behind the house, in a, well, it's a very small picturesque brownfield site, the site of an old tannery, which has been up for sale for almost as long as I've been living in this house, and has recently been sold for development, but nothing's happened, and there is apparently, and everything has stalled because they took core samples and they found asbestos. I don't know in what sort of form, whether it was in sort of asbestos cement or if it was fibrous asbestos, but we knew it was there already because other people, when the site was going on the market, it was determined that there was asbestos there. Maybe the purchaser has just found out that there's more of it than he thought. But again, it's just everything stalled and the site's still there, covered with weeds and not doing anything because of the asbestos. If we really want to clear up the asbestos problem, it is going to be a long-term project and it's going to take an awful lot of money and manpower.
Well, what the MPs are specifically asking for is the HSE to start stepping up its inspection program again, because its enforcement and inspection work has really tailed off over the past 10 years. Its funding has halved, or at least its government funding has halved in the past 10 years. It's got some of that back by slapping charges on people who it visits who are in breach of the law. But there's been a massive drop in the amount of enforcement work that the HSE does, and they want the MPs are recommending the HSE really steps up its inspection and enforcement activity with regard to asbestos and starts, you know, getting to grips with the situation rather than just thinking it's a problem that's somehow been solved already when it clearly hasn't.
Well, that's all very well, but I'm sure the HSE would say, you know, while we're having to labour under funding cuts, you know, if we've got less money, we can't do more work. It's all very well to ask them to step up their inspections, but if they haven't got the money or the people to do the inspections, how are they going to do that?
I don't think the HSE will be at all disappointed that the MPs are making this demand of them, because it gives the HSE ammunition to go back to government and saying, look, we've been telling you for ages we need more people, and even your, you know, the MPs, the House of Commons are saying we need more people. You know, give us more people, give us money. So it gives the HSE ammunition in there. The HSE don't want to not spend money and don't want to have fewer inspections. They want to do more and more. You know, they're not the bad guys here.
Yeah.
So it's not like HSE being told off here, but it's recommendations for HSE, which government will have to fund. Well, you and I, the taxpayer, will have to fund.
Yes, sure.
But the whole asbestos, you know, every time this comes back into the news, the whole story of the construction industry, I guess worldwide, it seems to be from a succession of wonder product to nightmare product, and that something that comes along and some new solution is the brave new world, and then we discover, oh no, it's terrible, you can't do that. And I don't think there's been anything quite as spectacular as asbestos, but look what we're doing with ACM cladding at the moment. They've put it all up everywhere, and now we're taking it all down again, saying, oh, that was the wrong product. And there are people who say, oh, we can't build things out of concrete or cement because that's an environmentally bad guy and it's too carbon intensive. And so we're having to rethink our production of that. I mean, no, I don't think anyone's suggesting we go away taking out all the mortar out of brick walls, but there's a backlash against what for a long time, and I think by and large still, is seen as a perfectly sensible, I wouldn't say harmless, but acceptable building brick of the industry.
But I think you've touched on something quite interesting there, because I was looking at a YouTube channel, which I occasionally look at, a science channel, and this particular episode is entitled "The Man Who Accidentally Killed the Most People in the World." Sorry, the man who accidentally killed the most people in history.
And accidentally, did you say?
Accidentally. Well, unintentionally. Not accidentally, because he worked very hard at this. I cannot remember the name of the chap, but he was a man who... There was a problem in the early years of motor cars, of phenomenon known as knocking in internal combustion engines, where you get premature detonation of the fuel-air mixture before the piston gets to the top. So they needed to find some way of retarding the ignition. And they tried all sorts of things. And this scientist who worked for, I think it was General Motors, finally, after testing all sorts of substances, came up with a lead compound, which is why we got lead in the petrol. And what it did was it prevented the fuel from igniting before you wanted it to ignite in the engine. It solved this problem of knocking. So lead was put into petrol, and you know, it did the job. It was perfect. The thing was, everybody already knew that lead was poisonous. It was a well-known fact. And of course, now it was being pumped out through exhaust pipes into the atmosphere. Now, I cannot remember, because it's a while since I watched this video, but the number of people who died prematurely as a result of lead poisoning, and the other problems caused by lead poisoning, which include mental impairment, because it affects your mental processes. So intelligence of the population was impacted as well, and also behavior. Lead poisoning, and another well-known side effect of lead poisoning is it causes delinquency. Don't ask me how it happens, but it does. And there is a very frightening correlation between the increase in antisocial behavior and violent crime and the increase in blood lead levels. And this man single-handedly invented this or developed this and promoted this thing. And after he'd done that, General Motors had another division, which was air conditioning and refrigeration. And the refrigerants used back then were pretty dangerous, ammonium and various other chemicals which were highly flammable and potentially explosive, and they wanted something safer. So this chap found a product, a chemical compound, which he called Freon, which we know more these days as some carbofluorocarbons, something, CFCs. Okay. Anyway.
This is the same guy, is it? The same guy who put lead in engines put CFCs.
He put lead in petrol and he put CFCs into refrigeration. The same guy.
Wow.
I'll tell you the name of the YouTube channel. I mean, obviously I'm not getting paid to promote this particular channel, but it's called Veritasium. V-E-R-I-T-A-S-I-U-M. Veritasium. It's an Australian scientist who has absolutely fascinating videos. I think this is his latest one, actually. Watched it only last night. But anyway, yeah. So this is a very long-winded way of backing up what you just said. You know, history is littered with these examples of something being hailed as a wonderful solution to a problem, only to find that it's created another one quite inadvertently. And asbestos, of course, is a very good example of that.
But you talking about the man who inadvertently killed more people than any other, and then started talking about cars, made me wonder whether the man who saved more lives, and this was not at all inadvertent, Ralph Nader, the American safety campaigner who effectively safe seatbelts in cars mandatory.
Ah, okay.
I mean, he wrote a book on car safety, automobile safety, and it led to the National Traffic and Motor Vehicle Safety Act in 1966 being passed in the USA, seatbelt becoming compulsory in 49 states. And I don't know whether seatbelts were already compulsory in other parts of the world, but it made seatbelts become the norm. And I'm sure seatbelts must have saved.
Hmm.
It's hard to think of a device that might have saved as many lives.
No, that's a very good point. Yeah, incredible. Yeah. Well, now you can't, you know, you can't operate an excavator unless you've got your 3-point safety belt properly buckled up. And if it's not properly buckled up and you're not sitting on the seat, you can't start the engine. So that's how far we've come.
Yes. Should we move on to our final topic of the day?
Yeah. Yes, let's talk about public art. or public art by default, I suppose. It's this story that you posted, I think, just a couple of days ago about, we've talked a lot about Tideway, you know, the Tideway project in London, which is this new super sewer, which it's a fascinating job and highly impressive. Have you seen some of the photographs of the shafts that they've dug? It's astonishing. But they are, obviously, the thing about sewers is they do tend to emit noxious smells. So you've got to vent those somehow. And so the Tideway project, I think they're going to install, is it nine chimneys, ventilation shafts? Well, chimneys on the top of the ventilation shaft down the route of the tunnel.
I know that there are nine sites. I don't know if it's just one chimney per site or whether there might be, I don't know, the need for two structures on one site. But I think it's just the nine chimneys. And they look like they're doing quite a nice job of it, don't they?
Well, yes. I have to say, I think they look nice from a distance. But if you scroll down your story, there's a close-up. I should describe what these things are. They're 5 meters high, sort of rather twisty columns. They look a little bit like cough candy twists. They're supposed to resemble some sort of fluid vortex. I think there's a nod there to what's going on underground. But they're these rather elegant 5 meter tall chimneys cast out of a very expensive sounding alloy. It's nickel aluminium bronze, which sounds to me like a metal that can't make up its mind. But it's I looked it up, and it's the strongest copper alloy you can get. They use it for ships' propellers and bearings and stuff like that. I don't know why it needs to be so have such high tensile strength just to vent sewage gases. But anyway, they've chosen this particular alloy. And from a distance, it looks really nice. It's a sort of an elegant sweeping contour with this twist in it. But close up, it's got a really rough finish. Looks like somebody's been over it with an angle grinder and just tried to knock off the...
I think it gives it texture. It gives it... You don't want it sort of smooth and whatever. It gives it a texture and an industrialness. Is that a word? Industrialness? Yeah. Industry.
No, it's not. But, well, it is now. They're also embossed with poems, which is something I also disapprove of. Because I think that...
Oh, go on. What's wrong with poetry?
There's nothing wrong with poetry. But I must confess that I have a deep suspicion of all public art, actually. Most of it, I think, is awful. Do you remember that ghastly... I've never seen it in the flesh. There's that in the new St. Pancras station, there's that statue of two... lovers supposedly meeting each other after a long journey. It looks awful to my mind. I don't like the Angel of the North. It's just a personal thing. And at Ilfracombe, one of my local towns, there's an awful Damien Hirst sculpture of a dissected pregnant girl standing on a pile of books, which is, it's Damien Hirst, so it's done for effect. Absolutely no artistic value that I can see. So I always look askance at attempts at tarting up our built environment with artistic endeavours. I think that most of the time it doesn't work. And I'd say almost 100% of the time they're divisive, because you will get people who love it and you'll get people who hate it. I'm usually in the latter camp. I think these chimneys look, as I say, I think they look nice from a distance. I think they'd look nicer if they were polished. Because there's something really nice about the way polished bronze weathers. You know, you look at a Henry Moore sculpture and it's this beautiful sort of browny, greeny, really tactile sort of curvaceous surface. And that's what makes Henry Moore sculptures so appealing, I think. Yeah, I'm sure that the rough text with this particular chimney that we see in the picture on the website, which you posted, will appeal to a lot of people. It clearly appeals to you. You like the look of that, well, that texture, don't you?
I like texture, but more importantly, it would have been so easy for this just to have been a chippy concrete column looking ugly, and they've made an effort to make something interesting that defines a place, and making little... Around each of these, I want to call it a statue, but these arty chimneys will be some benches, probably of the same sort of bronzy looking type material, and small, I don't know, play areas, but a little public site, somewhere to have your sandwich or a fag or something.
And
I just think it's all about placemaking, and I think that's the beauty of public art. And you say you're genuinely not a fan. And of course there are some things that I haven't seen the Ilfracombe thing you're talking about, but I seem to remember seeing pictures of it. I can't remember, but I seem to remember it being a story when it was put up. But I mean, anything Anthony Gormley has done, I'm a sucker for. Even those, and it's not Anthony Gormley, but they're all over the place now. Those two-dimensional cut out of World War One infantry soldiers, which are everywhere and all over the place. Whenever I see one of those, and our local timber merchant's got one outside the gate, I look and just go, yeah, I know where I am.
I think the one thing I'm generally in favour of, I should put this on, if Tideway's listening, I'm generally in favour of their chimneys. I like the look of them. I think they're a lovely shape. But I think the interesting thing is the fact that this is basically a functional thing. They've got to put a pipe there to get rid of the smelly gases.
Exactly.
And they're doing something nice to do that.
This is this is not, in the words of 10cc, art for art's sake. This is turning a necessary, functional, boring bit of kit into something which enhances, in my mind, I think it will, other people may disagree, but enhances the area in which it sits.
Yes, or at least doesn't make it look any worse. I think it probably would. If they're going to make a little park or picnic area around it, that's even better. And that's quite an achievement, isn't it, to attract people for relaxation purposes to the site of a sewage vent pipe. I think that's pretty good.
Does, now you put it like that.
That's an achievement in itself.
Come and sniff some sewage ventilation.
It put me in mind of a story of a year or two ago about what HS2 were doing with their vent pipes, because, of course, we talked about the HS2 tunnels in the Chilterns before now, a lot. And, of course, railway tunnels need ventilation chimneys.
And, well, they're access shafts as well, I think, aren't they?
I didn't realise they're just access as well. But they got, it was Nicholas Grimshaw, the architect, who designed buildings to go on top of these shafts to look like agricultural buildings, to look like barns, in other words. Not sort of, you know, beautiful old timber-framed barns with clay tiles that they'd have in your neck of the woods, but actually modern agricultural buildings. I wouldn't say they look particularly attractive. They look no more attractive than any other sort of at-cost barn, basically, but they don't look out of place. That was the point, because they're in the Chilterns, they're in the countryside, and you expect to see a modern barn in the field. And so that's what you'll see when you see one of these access shafts. You won't see an industrial building, you'll see an agricultural building.
Yes, I don't know if Grimshaw's, you said, designed them all, or whether different architects. I know Grimshaw was certainly associated with one or two of them, I think.
Oh, right, okay, I thought he did.
Maybe he did. But yeah, it's making something utilitarian, not only fit, but enhance the countryside. And I think you're perhaps doing down the HS2 barns. I think they actually are. They are as appealing as any sort of pseudo rustic building that Centre Parks might put up, any other holiday park developer. We've only got the CGIs to go on at the moment. We haven't yet seen the actual things. You say the arty chimneys in London reminded you of the HS2 barns. What actually came to my mind is one of the most ubiquitous, not so much now, but in our earlier lives, Dave, one of the most ubiquitous industrial buildings, utilitarian buildings, was the K6 telephone box designed by Giles Gilbert Scott. The red phone box, was everywhere. Okay, no one uses phone boxes anymore.
I think you can even call that iconic. Not a word we use very often.
I would go that far. And people, will buy them to put in their garden or to make into showers or something, and have them as an objet d'art. And it was essentially just a phone box, and they were controversial when they first started. I gather they were, you know, red and obtrusive and in your face and not very subtle, but they define the street, that, you know, the British high street for many years.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. The one looking into this story, I think if you really want to find a structure that raises sewage treatment to high art, the go-to example is Crossness Pumping Station, which is in the London borough of Bexley. I think it's on the edge of Erith Marshes. I understand.
Southeast London, and, isn't it?
Southeast London. Yeah, this is Sir Joseph Bazalgette. I never know how to pronounce his name. Is it Bazalgette or Bazalgette? But we know who I'm talking about. The chap who basically built the original London sewers and solved the problem of the big stink back in the Victorian era. Well, this pumping station, which is the Beckton of its day, obviously on the other side of the Thames, Crossness Pumping Station.
I haven't looked it up. How do you spell Crossness? I don't know it.
Well, as you would expect, CROSSNESS. Google it and find the images, because it looks like a Hindu temple.
It's incredible.
Wow. It's a Grade One listed building now, and you can go and visit it. It's an amazing building, absolutely stunning.
Inside and out, but more inside.
Inside and out. Oh, inside, it's astonishing. The cast ironwork is really extravagant, is the only way I can describe it. I mean, it's so far away from looking utilitarian. You couldn't possibly think, if you really wanted to build, like, for example, a staircase or a balustrade inside a pumping station, it would be as simple and as basic as you could possibly get it, made out of the cheapest materials. Well, these are ornate, painted, cast iron balustrades with all sorts of filigree details in them. It's astonishing.
It does look like a temple of worship to something.
It does. It really does. I would urge you to go and have a look. Crossness Pumping Station. And that is that's a sewage treatment works, folks. It's not a palace. Although I see there was obviously a Wikipedia page for this, and I noticed that it had four large steam engines steam pumps to pump the sewage. And maybe a nod towards the palatial characteristics, these engines were named Victoria, Prince Consort, Albert Edward and Alexandra. So it was clearly an incredibly prestigious project at the time. It's rather nice, actually, when I think about it. The more I read about Crossness Pumping Station is that Tideway is the Crossness. We're basically sort of repeating history. You know, Bazalgette is credited with having really sorted out the sewage problem in London 150 years ago. Now, of course, London is much, much bigger and has an awful lot more sewage to deal with. And Tideway is doing the same thing again. This is what Tideway is. It's maybe not quite as pretty as Crossness, but it's doing its bit.
Right. Well, that's from tunnels back to tunnels.
Yes, indeed.
Now, it's a bank holiday weekend this weekend, another public holiday. Got any plans, David? Doing any celebrating?
Yeah, we're going to visit some friends in South Devon. So we're going to go across Dartmoor.
Across the moors.
That way. Yeah. What about you?
I believe there's some May Day facilities at our local brewery I might have to help support.
Yes, very good idea.
Partaking in a hog roast or some such. But we are not back next week, are we? We are...
No, sadly, no.
So with many thanks...
Back to our fortnight.
With many thanks to our kind sponsors for the past few months, we are returning to our fortnightly cycle for the summer months, and we hope to be back to weekly when we can, but at the moment we will be back with you in second week of May, I guess.
Two weeks time. I believe it's the 11th.
Right. I have no idea what will be in the news that week, but David and I look forward to talking about it. But for now, from David and I, thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.